Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Swung on and missed. He went fishing. 11 strikeouts for Corey Kluber. 30th pitch of the inning for Greg Holland. Fly ball, center field. Blackman chasing. Dodge can't get it. Guyer scores the tie run. Zimmer will be stopped at third. Austin Jackson delivers. Down to his last strike. It's a 1-1 game. Now go swings. High fly ball. Deep center. Back is Blackman. The Indians come back and stun the Rockies with four in the bottom of the ninth.
I knew I got it. I knew it was gonna hit the wall or something. I knew we ended the game right there. It was kind of funny because I'm rounding second and Kipnis is running towards me. I'm like, oh, get out. It's a home run, man. And I was just waiting for umpire or something to say, like, oh, stop at second or something, because he's like high-fiving me at second. I've never done that before.
Boy, you know, when a guy hits a home run to lead off a game, you don't think that that's going to stand up. But the way their guy was pitching, I mean, it about did. But boy, we had some good at-bats in the ninth, though. Austin's at-bat, he had never gotten a hit off that guy and just kept fighting and probably fouled one by about as little as you can. Just a great at-bat. Well, it feels good when you win. I mean, that's what you're setting out to do. I don't think we get too dramatic in there during a game. We're just trying to win. You feel bad when Brantley gets out. You know, you worry for him, but you still have to win the game.
That's some kind of lineup, too. I mean, there's no let-up in that lineup. You know, first couple hitters of the game, home run, single, and then nothing. It's fun to watch.
All schools aren't created equal. David Shaw once said, we don't recruit certain areas of the country because we know those guys can't qualify to go to Stanford. So there's some truth to that. But listen, you're at UCLA. That's where you chose to go. So you have to adhere to those academic requirements. Don't pick on guys in the SEC. Don't pick on Alabama just because those guys go to a school where the academic requirements aren't as stiff.
When you think about the comment, keep in mind 1% of people actually make it to the NFL.
Yes.
So, yeah, I had high aspirations. I was going to make it to the NFL. I also had tons of buddies that had the same aspirations that didn't make it to the NFL. So I don't like the comment from that standpoint because you still need to go and get an education.
Yeah.
And there needs to be a backup plan. I'm fine with that being your main plan, but you better say, I'm going to pay attention in school just in case this doesn't work. Now I have a future.
Feel good about the team. Everything that they're doing now, they've already done. They're doing for a second time. And the amount of growth that you can have from doing something for the first time and then doing it the next time can be the biggest leap they have their entire college career. So going from their freshman year to their sophomore year, very excited for that class. Also excited for the junior class. It's hard to believe now that first got hired at Michigan and signed a class a month later that those guys are now juniors. The way we won 9 straight games, and you know, everybody's high-fiving in the locker room after the game. And they were also there when we lost 3 out of our last 4 games. They know what it feels like. They like the feeling of the high-fiving better than the other. And maybe that's going to motivate them even more.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Wow. What a montage put together there by the one and only Mr. James Cushlin. Well done, sir. A lot of material there to work with, and we're going to try to work our way through as much of it as we can. Welcome to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo's sports leader, and our phone lines are going to be open at 866-240-1065. In particular, in this hour, starting now, really, as we'll get through our montage here in a moment, but our first guest isn't until about 4:10 today. At about 4:10, we're going to talk to Nick Baumgartner, our old friend from MLive.com up there in Michigan. He is on the Wolverines beat. We're going to check in. Told you yesterday I wanted to get a little bit more college-centric. We're all excited about the start of the National Football League's preseason, but they're working hard in Columbus, and they're working hard in Ann Arbor, and they're working hard in East Lansing, and they're working hard at South Bend, and they're working hard at Bowling Green, and they're working hard at Toledo. And we want to start to pay a little bit more attention to the start of the college football season, which is steamrolling toward us. Even a little bit faster than the start of the National Football League season is. So we're going to talk to Nick Baumgartner about Michigan. You heard a little bit of Jim Harbaugh there. Also, a little bit more on Josh Rosen. You heard Booger McFarland and David Pollack from ESPN talking about the Josh Rosen comments that we addressed at some length, in some depth, too, yesterday. And I've got more thoughts on that today. And more of a reason to be upset with Josh Rosen, by the way. You know, I pondered all of his concerns and complaints and said, you know, he's right. It really, really is hard. You know, to have two full-time jobs, one being college football player and one being college student. It's really hard, and you can understand why he said these two things don't go together. But then I thought about it, and I thought to myself, does he have it any harder than any other college student, both at the time you're in college and for years and years after the fact? I'll explain what I mean by that as we continue. But I've got a lot on the Rosen story. Baseball just ticks me off. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't care about Yan Gomes' walk-off home run last night. I don't even care about Corey Kluber. I mean, I do care because I marvel at Corey Kluber. I don't know if he's going to be in the Cy Young, or he is in the race. Make no mistake. I don't know if he's going to win the Cy Young again, win his second, but I feel like, my goodness, Chris Sale is going to have to do something spectacular in the last month and a half to keep up with what Corey Kluber is doing. Kluber went into last night's game, just to throw this at you, against the Rockies, on a historic run. Over his last 12 starts, going into last night, in 12 starts since coming off the DL, 1.77 ERA, and 131 strikeouts in 86 innings. That's a 13.66 strikeouts per nine innings rate if you're looking for it. Holy cow. Overall, he's third in the AL in ERA, but only 0.07 runs behind the leaders James Paxton and Chris Sale. He's also second in batting average against, 201 to Sale's 198. Again, I mean, literally neck and neck. He's second in whip, 0.95 to Sale's 0.91. Again, neck and neck. He's second in shutouts with 2 to Irvin Santana's 3. He's second in strikeouts per 9 innings overall to Sale, 12.52 to 12.68, neck and neck. And, oh, by the way, he's fourth in WAR, 4.5 to Sale's 4.7. So you're talking about a guy, and this is before last night. Before Corey Kluber went out there and dominated the Colorado Rockies and almost didn't have a win to show for it again. Kluber, ridiculous, not another complete game, 9 innings, 3 hits, gave up just the 1 run, walked nary a batter, and struck out 11 freaking more. ERA down now to 2.65, and that might be enough to actually overtake Sale with that 9-inning performance last night. I'll have to check on that. I don't have the stats directly in front of me for the league. But Corey Kluber had another spectacular game. And then, of course, Yan Gomes, who has been, you know, an enigma at the plate all season long, just cannot seem to get in any kind of a groove, hitting 226 last night. Then he hits the game-winning walk-off home run. But when I said baseball ticks me off, here's why. Because you turn around and play a day game today, and you've got a lead, and you hand the ball to your closer, and once again, your closer doesn't close. I am so sick and tired. Quite frankly, you got a 2-1 lead, and Cody Allen makes me sweat every time he walks to the hill. Every single time. He frustrates me because he just throws as hard as he can, and it's not hard enough. He doesn't have 99. He's got 96 and 97, maybe, depending on the pitch. He doesn't have enough movement on that. And he just gets himself drilled far too often. His ERA as a closer is 3.38. That's not good. That's not good enough. And he blew the save here again today. He even in saves that he gets, it's very, very Joe Borowski, very, very Bob Wickman-y when it comes to Cody Allen's saves. Unlike those guys who threw junk and tried to outsmart hitters, he's got the physical talent in the arm, but he does not have enough pitches, or he does not have enough movement on his pitches that he does throw. Cody Allen is just a wild card every time he comes in. Great job by Trevor Bauer today, and yet another start. He struck out 9, did not walk a batter, scattered 7 hits over 7 innings. Just one earned run. Trevor Bauer has found something. He has found some sort of magic. I don't know how to describe it, but his last let me just take a look at his game log real quick if I can. Trevor Bauer, here are his last three starts. Do I want to go through? Hold on here, and let me try to find this. Yeah, Trevor Bauer's last three starts. In a 13-3 win over the 13-3 win over the Toronto Blue Jays on July 21st, five innings, not a great, great long period of time, but still, three runs allowed in a victory. He did get the victory to move to 8-8. Then on the 27th of July against the Angels, eight innings of dominant baseball, seven hits, one run. He struck out six, walked only one. He has really found control of his pitches in another win to move to 9-8 on the season. Then against the Yankees just on Friday, it was Trevor Bauer going seven innings, scattering seven hits again, one run, and he struck out seven, walked only two, got the win, 10-8, lowering his ERA. His ERA has fallen since June 7th from 6.10 to, where is he now today after this, to 4.79. After today, and then the today start I just read to you, he was tremendous, absolutely tremendous. Seven innings, seven hits, one earned run, no walks, nine strikeouts. He has just been phenomenal. As a matter of fact, I don't have the, I was going to say the month, but it kind of spans July and the beginning of August. So Trevor Bauer has been terrific. Corey Kluber has been terrific. Carlos Carrasco has hit some rough spots in recent days. And Danny Salazar is a little up and down. We know that Tomlin is in the... is on the DL, and he's pretty much done. So, I don't know. It's just frustrating. They handed the game to their closer, and the closer, Cody Allen, just gave it away. So that's the baseball news that we have for you right now. Not really too much quick news at all in Tiger Town. Am I right, Jim Cushman?
No, not really at this point on the Tigers. They've now lost four straight, dropping one in Pittsburgh. The series shifts to Comerica Park, and it is a Verlander start tonight. You were asking about Kluber. No, he is still second right now in the AL and ERA, 265, sales at 257 on the year. And one little side note, too, about Kluber last night.
Yeah.
Because it was the complete game effort, three hits. Actually, spun this way, he walked nobody, struck out 10, and only allowed one hit in eight innings. Because of the first inning, the game started with Homer single, one hit the rest of the way, and 10 more of the strikeouts.
Wow.
That's incredible.
That's a great stat. And you're right, it is incredible. He has just been fantastic. And, I guess Chris Sale still has the edge. You know, I look at these things and think to myself, in what way can I make my guy the winner here? But Chris Sale probably still has the edge. He's leading in wins by a lot. He's got 14 wins. That's not Kluber's fault. He hasn't gotten a lot of run support in some of those great dominating performances he has had.
And, of course, he was out a month hurt, too.
What's that?
And he was out a month hurt, too, of course.
And he was out a month, that's right. So you know, that's going to contribute to that. ERA 2.57 to 2.65, and we can go into all of those stats again. I already did, but boy, he is making a case for it. And I'll tell you something else. You know what? I think it's fair, maybe, if we do this, if the Red Sox are somehow overtaken by the Yankees, and the Yankees are kind of scuffling, especially after all the big trades the Yankees made. I'm surprised by this, but the Yankees are kind of struggling a little bit. They've lost six of their last 10. They're four back. But if the Yankees win the division and the Indians win the division, can you argue if the numbers are almost identical in every category as they have been, and especially the run that Kluber has been on in the second half, if he keeps that up for 6 weeks? I mean, can you argue maybe that just, you know, the guy who pitched his team to a division championship? Just saying. Right now, that would also be Sale, because they would both, you know, they both have four-game leads in their respective divisions. It's just that I think the Yankees might mount more of a challenge to the Red Sox in the East than the Royals will to the Indians in the Central. The Royals, by the way, have hit the skids at the wrong time, too. The Indians have not been playing lights out. They just split four with the Yankees. Now they're about to split, potentially, these two with the Rockies. This would be a great chance for Kansas City to be on a roll. They're not. They've lost seven of their last 10, including two in a row. So it's a four-game spread between the Indians and the Royals right now. All right, so that's a whole lot of baseball stuff, a little bit more than I probably want to get into. I just got mad at Cody Allen, so I needed a vent for a little while. We're going to the bottom of the 10th now. One other baseball story that I found interesting today. How about Major League Baseball channeling Vince McMahon in the XFL? Did you hear this, Jim? Do you know what they're doing on August 25th to the 27th?
No. What is this all about?
Major League Baseball is going He Hate Me for a weekend. That's right. Major League Baseball, together with the Players Association, announcing today a group of initiatives aimed at letting players express themselves while connecting with their past in youth baseball. From August 25 to August 27, players will wear alternate jerseys inspired by youth league designs, and they can replace their last names with nicknames on their jersey nameplates. Players will be able to declare their nicknames ahead of time, which will enable their fans to buy the jerseys with those nicknames on them if they so choose, much like the NBA did back in 2014. Player nicknames will even be included on the back of the New York Yankees jerseys, the first time any nameplate has been back on the back of the Yankees jerseys. As we know, their pinstripes and grays are nameless. Yankee shortstop D.D. Gregorius will be known as Sir D.D. I don't know why. Maybe that's what he had in his youth, but he will be Sir D.D. Other nicknames already declared, the Braves second baseman Brandon Phillips will be known as Dat Dude, D-A-T-D-U-D-E, Dat Dude. Toronto Blue Jays outfielder Jose Bautista will be, I'm sure you can probably guess this one, Kush.
Joey Bats on that
Joey
one?
Joey Bats.
All right.
You will say Joey Bats on the bat. I wonder if these guys are just going to go to their Twitter handles. Go to your Twitter handle or your Instagram name. And put it on the back of your jersey.
Well, at least one of them I know did that on this list, as
Who's
I
that?
Found it. Bauer.
Oh, Trevor Bauer?
Yep. He's going to be Bauer Outage,
Outage,
I believe is the beginning of his Twitter handle.
Francisco Lindor, if you're looking for him, is going to be what everybody loves, especially the ladies, about him, his smile. He is Mr. Smile on the back of his Indians jersey for that weekend. Pirates outfielder Andrew McCutchen is just going with the short, simple, sweet Cutch. And that's kind of fun. I really do. I think it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
It's something, you know, what have we said for a long, long time? We have talked about how baseball has not done enough to connect the personalities
yes.
of the game with the fans the way basketball has. It's a star-driven league run by LeBron James, Steph Curry, you know, Russell Westbrook to an extent, you know, Kevin Durant. It's a star league, and everybody can connect with them. The National Football League, too, in many ways, you know, with Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady, these super marketable guys. But baseball has not really found a way to do that. You just don't see a lot of commercials, and you don't find a lot of, tremendous followings for baseball players. So how do they do it? Well, this is one way. Let's let some of their personality shine through. Let me give a few others, just for fun. Sean Doolittle of the Nationals. During the weekend of August 25th to the 27th, when players are allowed to wear their nicknames on the back of their jerseys, is just do with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It looks like 8 zeros for Sean Doolittle, who will just be do. Kyle Seager, the Mariners, his nameplate is going to say Corey's brother.
I'm reading the same one. That's my favorite one so
Corey's
far.
Corey's brother is classic. Robinson Cano of the Mariners. Don't you know? And I'm surprised he doesn't have the question mark at the end of that.
Right.
I probably would. I love Carl Edwards Jr. of the Cubs as well, only because I love their sandwiches, and God, do I love their commercials. Carl's Jr. for Carl Edwards Jr. It's going to be Carl's Jr. on the back of his jersey, which is simply classic. David Price of the Red Sox, former Tiger. This is going to be Astro's dad. I don't know who Astro is. I'm going to assume it's like his dog or something. But his might as well be Red Ass or something like that, because David Price has become one of the biggest pains in the A, I think, that you're going to find in Major League Baseball these days. He is constantly fighting with somebody. There's a story there about his brawls with Hall of Famer Dennis Eckersley, who's been doing some of the color commentary in place of Jerry Remy, who's having cancer treatments. Dennis Eckersley got bombarded by David Price for simply complaining about a performance that somebody had in a rehab assignment. And David Price started a war of words with him. He is just looking to fight all the time. But anyway, he's got Astro's dad. Aaron Judge. That one might be my new favorite one. Aaron Judge, the back of his jersey is simply going to say, "All rise." Love that. All rise for the judge. Andrew Triggs of the A's is going to have trigonometry. Former Tiger Max Scherzer of the Nationals, a leading Cy Young candidate in the NL. Blue Eye. He has just one blue eye, so he's going to be Blue Eye. Aroldis Chapman of the Yankees is going to have the missile. Pretty doggone accurate, I would say. And I kind of like Todd Frazier of the Yankees, too. Todd Frazier's is pretty fun. Todd Father. The Todd Father. I like that as well. So, you know, as more of these come in, they don't have to declare these things yet. What is today, the 9th? So they've got they got a couple of weeks here. 2 weeks from Friday, the 25th, is when they'll start wearing those. So they'll I think they've got to declare them as soon as possible, like they said, so they can put these things on sale for fans to buy.
But right.
I kind of like it, Jim. It's a way to personalize these guys, maybe bring them out of their, you know, their shadows, if you will, and the shadow of the dugout, and you just don't get an opportunity to see too many of these guys in a way that, where you can build the brand of the sport around them the way they do in the NBA.
And that, you know, and that ties into something that, as you let off with this subject on, which is that we and many others have talked about over time that this is one of baseball's problems, is somehow getting the stars, you know, truly markable. This isn't going to solve everything, but I'll tip my cap on this level, because it's a start. Baseball has to start with something to get this out there, to start challenging these other sports.
There's what I really want to know, though, is, I mean, there were some stars there, obviously. I just gave some names. You know, Max Scherzer is a Cy Young candidate. Aaron Judge is an MVP candidate, and so on and so forth. But what are, what are these guys going to, you know, the big stars going to do? What's Bryce Harper going to have? What's Mike Trout going to have? What's Miguel Cabrera going to have? Is it just going to be Miggy? Probably Miggy, right, for Miggy?
Until I hear otherwise, that'd be my assumption.
What are some of these guys going to have? I find it very curious, or I am very curious, I should say, to see what, especially if it's a more of a dressed down, you know, quiet, non self promoting kind of a guy like Trout, one of the greatest players at this age. He just turned 26, one of the greatest players, for his first few years in baseball in the history of the game. Doesn't like the spotlight, doesn't like the cameras, doesn't like to do a lot of talking. He probably won't want to do a lot of self-expressing with his nickname. I wonder if it'll just be simple, something simple. I mean, I'm very curious about that. Harper, on the other hand, would he go back to his introduction to the sporting world when he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated at age 16 with the headline, "Baseball's Chosen One"? A takeoff of the, or send up of the LeBron James cover from years before that.
I got a feeling he won't, but he almost should. Just to spark a controversy, he'll get people talking. That's what baseball needs right now.
Bryce Harper, by the way, I think is more well known even than for his stats right now. If you really kind of, listen to some of the national conversations, it's all about the hair. It's all about Bryce Harper's hair. That is what everybody talks about. He loves, of course, big, long, flowing locks hanging out from underneath that hat when his helmet flies off as he's running the bases and the outfield and so on. He loves the hair, and I wonder if it'll have something to do with the hair. But they really do. They need to use these guys and market them. What's Giancarlo Stanton going to have? I'm just trying to think of some big star names and what some of these guys could have, because I think it's going to be really fun. What will Chris Sale have? What will Corey Kluber have? Would he have Klubot?
Ooh, good question. I hope so.
I don't know if he embraces that, or he doesn't certainly oppose it. But Corey Kluber, for those who don't know, and how do you not know, Corey Kluber is known by many, including the media out there in Cleveland, as Klubot, because he's like a robot. He shows no emotion. He could strike out the side on nine pitches and walk off the field emotionless. He could give up a three-run bomb to lose the game and be taken out, and he'll walk off the field emotionless in between pitches. No emotion. He just looks so controlled, like a robot. His name is Klubot. I wonder if he goes Klubot. That would be very interesting. For me, I'm partial to Die Hard, so I would have Hans on the back of his jersey because I love Hans Kluber.
Nice.
That is always my favorite. But there's a lot of really fun things that could happen there. Okay. You know what else is fun? Doing the Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Indeed, and your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day today about home runs. A lot of them have been hit over the last few years. Talk about juice balls, guys striking out, and some of the big names. And not as young guys smacking bombs out of the ballparks at a record clip. Well, the player with the most home runs since the start of the 2016 season, that means last year and this year, who do you think it is? Is it going to be Mike Trout? No. Is it going to be Bryce Harper? No. Is it going to be Giancarlo Stanton? No. Is it going to be who are some of the? Is it going to be a Miguel Cabrera? No. Is it going to be? It's not going to be anybody. Is it not going to be Chris Bryant, NL MVP of a year ago? No. The guy who's hit the most home runs since the start of the 2016 season is Chris Davis of the Oakland A's, who has 72 bombs since the start of last season. How about that? Mel Allen might say, that is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Going to get a bottom of the hour sports center here when I come back. Got a lot of things to get into. Don't forget top of the hour. At about 4 o'clock, we're going to get into college football Michigan style. Nick Baumgartner will join us to talk about the Wolverines quarterback controversy or quarterback competition, whatever you want to call it. Three guys fighting for the job, one of which is last year's starter, Wilson Spate. So we'll talk a little bit about whether or not Wilton Spate, beg pardon, and we'll talk about whether or not he's going to keep his job and get a little bit of a feel for the Wolverines in camp as we get closer to college football. So that's coming up at the top of the hour. We'll open up the phone lines to you next at 866-240-1065 on The Ticket.
Back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Rolling onward, 341 now, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Talk a little college football coming up with Nick Baumgartner of MLive.com on the Wolverines beat. That'll be at about 4:10. In between now and then, we got a lot of other directions that we can travel. You know what we didn't talk about yesterday, Jim, that I kind of wish we would have?
Right.
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not a big fan of .com these days because I'm not a fan of some of the stuff that they publish. ESPN.com, that would be.
Okay.
Also a little bit too controversial much of the time is their ESPN.com-owned website, The Undefeated. Not a big fan of that sometimes because it's very divisive. It's very, very controversial. But what I do love that they put up yesterday, because what a tremendous debate that it can start. The top 50 black athletes of all time. The greatest 50 black athletes ever. Now, one could say, why black? Why not just the greatest 50 athletes? And that's a very good question. I would like to know the answer to that because, you know, I mean, a lot of black athletes have dominated a lot of sports more than whites. They might have just as much representation on a list of all-time just athletes, period. But since they did this, and the Undefeated focuses on minority athletics and minority issues in sports and so on and so forth, so it's fine. But what I love about it is, like I said, the wonderful debates that this prompts. There are some phenomenal names I'm going to give you on this list of the top 50 black athletes of all time that they put together. Some of them are surprising. And if you ask me, even if you look in the top 10, there are there's a lot of room for a lot of serious disagreement and debate. I would also point out that one of Detroit's favorite athletes and favorite sons, if you will, made the list right at the very bottom at number 49. And that would be Zeke himself. Number 49 is Isaiah Thomas, which I find very, very interesting. I think he's one of the greatest. He's certainly one of my favorite players of all time. I don't care about color. He's just one of my favorite players of all time. I've said that many times. Going back to his years at Indiana, I was a fan of his. I was a fan of Bobby Knight's. I was a fan of the whole thing, and I really started to root for Indiana basketball for a long time thereafter because of Isaiah Thomas. But he's on this list, and I just figured I'd run down some of these for you and see about where maybe disagreements might come about. The 50th greatest athlete of all time, black athlete of all time, according to ESPN's The Undefeated, is Tim Duncan. Tim Duncan? What? Yeah. Tim Duncan of 5 championships. Tim Duncan, maybe the greatest power forward in the history of the game, finished behind Isaiah Thomas. Now that's some serious respect for Zeke Thomas, the fact that he is above Tim Duncan. Tim Duncan checks in at 50, Zeke 49, number 48 is Earl Campbell. Number 47, I loved Earl Campbell too, one of my other favorite running backs of all time, probably one of my top 5. Derek Jeter. Number 46 is the Admiral. How about that? The Captain followed by the Admiral. We're just playing the military rank game here, aren't we? The Captain, Derek Jeter, preceded by the Admiral, David Robinson at 46. Number 45, Jolton Joe Frazier. Joe Frazier, one of the greatest heavyweight fighters in history who will never get his due because he kept losing. Well, he lost two of the three to Muhammad Ali. And the powerful puncher from Philadelphia, truly one of the greatest of all time. Probably too low on this list for my money. Other Detroiter, for those who are fans of the D, number 44 is Barry Sanders. Barry Sanders most definitely should be higher than that, in my opinion. Number 43, Reggie Jackson, Mr. October. Number 42, Larry Fitzgerald, the outstanding all-pro future Hall of Fame wide receiver with the Cardinals. Number 41, Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks. Number 40, God rest his soul, one of the greatest players and one of the greatest humanitarians in the history of baseball, the great Roberto Clemente. Number 39, one of two Sugar Rays. Sweetness abounds in Ray Robinson. That means, yes, Leonard is higher. We'll get there. Number 38 is Arthur Ashe, the great tennis legend and icon. Number 37, back to baseball, Ken Griffey Jr. Number 36, 11 championships, not enough to get him into the top half of the top 50, Bill Russell. 36. Number 35, another one of those great heavyweights that could have been higher if it weren't for Muhammad Ali beating him, George Foreman, the monster that he was. 35. Number 34, who, by the way, went on to win the heavyweight championship again at the age of 45 when he knocked out Michael Moore in the 1980s after some 15 or 17-year absence from the ring, whatever it was. Number 34, one of the greatest college running backs in the history of college football. Number 34 on the field and number 34 in this list, Herschel Walker. Number 33, Flo-Jo herself, Florence Griffith Joyner. Number 32, Carl Lewis. Got to be higher. How is Carl Lewis down at number 32? Carl Lewis, one of the greatest athletes in the history of athletics, period. Again, I don't care what color. Doesn't matter. He's on this list because they did the top 50 black athletes, but you could put him on a list of just top 50 athletes of all time, and to me, he's going to be in the top 10. He was that good. But he's 32 on this list. Number 31, Michael Johnson, the legendary 200 sprinter with every world record known to man. Number 30, a man that a lot of people would think is, or, you know, would probably count as the greatest football player in the history of the sport, only makes number 30 on the list of top black athletes, top 50 black athletes, Jim Brown, down there at number 30. And Jim, how surprised would you be to find out that the other greatest player probably in Cleveland sports history is right next to him? Number 29 is LeBron James. Wow. Number 28 is Steph Curry, the Warrior two-time MVP. Number 27 is Jackie Joyner Kersee, track and field standout. Number 26, the scoring machine that is Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain. Number 25, maybe the greatest athlete, pure athlete, who could do anything at any time because he knew baseball and he knew football. And he probably knew basketball, he knew hockey, he knew cycling, he knew rowing, he knew tennis, he knew it all, if you remember the commercial. Bo knew. Bo Jackson is number 25. Number 24 is arguably my favorite fighter ever, the aforementioned Sugar Ray Leonard. Loved Sugar Ray. Number 23, maybe the greatest heavyweight champion of all time, not named Muhammad Ali, Joe Louis. Number 22, Brazilian soccer icon Pelé. Number 21, Wilma Rudolph. Number 20, Gale Sayers. Oh, I wish I could have seen Gale Sayers play. His career was cut so short because of an injury, Jim, that we probably today take for granted. We hear about somebody having an ACL tear. Oh, he'll be out 6 months, 8 months, maybe a season, and yeah, he's back. But back then, in the 60s, it was career-defining. It was career-ending.
Yep.
They didn't have the technology. Gale Sayers was something special. He's up at number 20. He's preceded by number 19, the all-time rushing leader statistically, even if he's not the best all-time rusher, Emmitt Smith. Number 18, the great hero of the Negro Leagues, Satchel Paige. Number 17, my favorite basketball player of all time. That's right. I love me some Mike, and I love me some Larry Bird, and I love me some Pistol Pete Maravich, and I love me some Wilt Chamberlain. I love me some Patrick Ewing. I love me some Isaiah Thomas. Those are some of my greatest favorite all-time players. But my favorite forever and always will be Number six. Number 17 on this list, Dr. J, Julius Erving, 17th greatest black athlete in the history of sport, out of the top 50 that have been put together by the undefeated. Number 15, and this to me is a little bit controversial now, this is where you find Venus Williams. Venus, who's only the second best athlete, black athlete, in her family, because Serena is so much better. 15th greatest black athlete of all time? Greater than Bo Jackson? Greater than Ray Leonard? Greater than LeBron James? Greater than Jim Brown? Greater than Barry Sanders? Greater than Roberto Clemente? Ooh, that's harsh. I don't know if I can do that. Number 14, the greatest sprinter of all time. The formerly undefeated, now beaten in his last ever race by Justin Gatlin. It is, of course, Usain Bolt, the GOAT of the 100-meter dash. Number 13, basketball's all-time scoring leader, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Number 12, sweetness himself, Walter Payton, who, by the way, is higher than Jim Brown, higher than Barry Sanders, higher than Bo Jackson, higher than a lot of all these running backs that I've mentioned. Number 11... the point guard who redefined the position when he came in 1980. Of course, I'm talking about Magic Johnson. Number 10, the greatest ever to run a pass pattern in a National Football League stadium, Jerry Rice, GOAT status. And now we get into some more controversy. You ready for this? Numbers 9 and 8 are Gabby Douglas and Simone Biles. We're going with a couple of young gymnasts. Tremendous, yes, but tremendous in the context, in my opinion, when you're talking about all time, okay, in my opinion, I think you have to have been great for a very long time to be counted as a great all time. You have to be, have some, some not duration. What's the word I'm looking for here, Jim?
Longevity,
not even durability, but you have to have done it for a long time. There has to be more to you than just an Olympics games. That's why I mentioned Carl Lewis, who I said should be much, much higher. It's not just a single Olympic games. It was a series of Olympic games for Carl Lewis and world championships and so on and so forth. When you get into things like, Simone Biles and Gabby Douglas, as great as they were, it was for a very short time. You know, a single Olympics, great glory, you know, wonderful job of bringing gold home to the United States and all the rest. But numbers 9 and 8, ahead of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, ahead of, I don't know, some of the other people I remember, Pele, ahead of Magic Johnson, ahead of Jerry Rice, ahead of Carl Lewis. I mean, that's hard for me. So the two gymnasts back-to-back at 9 and 8. And I can't help but wonder how much of this is they had to get a few females in the top 10 in order to avoid anybody saying they were, biased or sexist. But this is, again, reading from the top 50 black athletes of all time, according to ESPN's The Undefeated. Number 7, the true home run king to this very day. The true home run king remains Hank Aaron. Hammer and Hank, 755, still the record as far as I and anybody else with an ounce of sense is concerned. Barry Bonds and his 7,762 steroid-aided home runs. Sorry, Hank Aaron, number 7, is on the list. By the way, it should say something that Barry Bonds is not on this list. Number 6, the greatest female tennis player of all time, exceeding Martina Navratilova, exceeding the exploits of the great Steffi Graf, Margaret Court, and anybody else you can think of, it's got to be Serena Williams, 6th greatest black athlete of all time, according to the undefeated. Number 5, now this one is a little tougher for me, only because I'm going to sound hypocritical. When I kind of said that Gabby Douglas and Simone Biles are ranked too high because all they did was give you a shining moment in the sun at an Olympics, that's what number 5, Jesse Owens, did. It was the 1936 Olympics, and it was just one time. But the difference between him and them and everybody else, of course, you have to put that performance into the context that it deserves. Jesse Owens didn't run at the L.A. Coliseum. Jesse Owens didn't run in Paris. Jesse Owens didn't run in Tokyo. Jesse Owens went to Berlin. A black man in the 1930s, with Hitler on the rise in 1936, declaring Aryan or white German superiority over virtually everyone else. Jesse Owens walked into the Olympic Stadium in Berlin and showed up Der Führer. Four gold medals, blowing by Hitler's Aryan superstars like they were standing still. The accomplishment of the four gold medals in one Olympics is not enough to make him number five on this list. But the circumstances in which he earned those four gold medals absolutely make him top five, and maybe he should be a little bit higher. Jesse Owens. Number four, say hey, it's Willie Mays. Not Willie Mays Hayes, no, the real Willie Mays. Maybe one of the top two or three greatest all around, that's offensive, defensive, average power, five tool players in the history of the world, Willie Mays. Number three, you knew he was going to be there. I actually thought he might be higher, but he's not. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Poor old man is stuck at number three, Muhammad Ali. And I just made that up, by the way. Sorry about how terrible it was. Muhammad Ali is number three. Number two, the man who broke the color barrier and endured hell on baseball diamonds and in arenas and in diners and everywhere else before the civil rights era. Jackie Robinson, number two, and the number one black athlete of all time, according to ESPN.com's The Undefeated. Of course, it would have to be basketball's GOAT. It would have to be Michael Jeffrey Jordan. So there you have it. There's, you know, and you could play around. Well, I would put Bo Jackson above Gale Sayers, or I would put Barry Sanders above Herschel Walker, or I would put Sugar Ray Robinson ahead of Sugar Ray Leonard, or I would put, you know what I mean? You can do some things here with track athletes. I would put Carl Lewis above Usain Bolt, and I would. Usain is at 14, Carl Lewis is at 32. And it's not, you know, USA versus Jamaica. It's Usain was a sprinter. That's it. Carl did it all. 100, 200, the relays, and the long jump, which is an entirely different game. It's a different event. Yes, it's almost a different sport. And he was the greatest in the world for a long period of time. To me, you've got that kind of versatility or higher. But you could argue, you know, Wilt Chamberlain should be behind Bill Russell because Russell won more championships when they played against each other head-to-head, all that stuff. You could have a lot of disagreements with it. But for me, the strongest disagreements would be those ones at the top. Do the two young gymnasts, Gabby Douglas and Simone Biles, belong in the top 10 of the greatest all-time black athletes? Does Serena in tennis belong there? Did Jesse Owens get ranked too low at number five, which I kind of feel like he did? Who else belongs in that top 10? I found it a fascinating discussion. And Jim, I'm going to ask you something here as we continue. I want to go to the phones, talk to Jimmy here for a second. Jimmy's in his regular slot. Cushlin, you tell me this. What famous black athlete who is one of the most dominant in the history of his sport is not on this list?
Oh, geez. I'm taking a look at it. I'm looking
recent,
at
recent, not old.
Okay, okay. That'll help. You kind of mentioned Bonds.
Nope.
He's, but I didn't.
That
think
would
that
be a
was,
good one. That would be a good one.
He's
that would
not
be a
on
really interesting one. Yeah, but maybe the voters at the Undefeated who put this list together, maybe they did the same thing I do and you do and a lot of other people do, and that is count the steroid factor against him.
Yeah, that's so clearly why he's not on this.
Yeah. So no, it's not, that's not who I was talking about.
Okay.
He's current. And again, he was one of the most dominant athletes, in the history of his sport. He's in a bit of a hiatus right now. I'm going to give it to you cause we're short on time.
Okay.
Tiger Woods.
You know, I was just looking at that and thinking that why
most,
that's ridiculous.
Second most majors in the history of golf, not on this list. Now, just to throw this at you, too, for those who are interested, The list that they put together of the top 50 greatest black athletes of all time included three categories. Actually, four if you count the overall one, but I think that's a composite of the other three. The three other categories are dominance, meaning just your straight dominance on the field of play or court or whatever. Impact on society, because there are some like Jackie Robinson, of course, breaking the color barrier, really changed baseball for everybody, including fans. And inspiration. How inspirational were they to others, you know, other young athletes to grow up and play their sport or do their thing? So, and then there was the overall rating. So just to, you know, throw it out there, maybe they don't consider, in Tiger Woods' case, golf to be an actual sport, as it were. These other sports are all, you know, running, throwing, catching, hitting, and so on and so forth, as opposed to golf, which is a very, very different type of, you know, athletic challenge. It's a largely a mental challenge, maybe more than a physical one. I don't know why they didn't keep Tiger on there. But, you know, if he might have ranked low on the issue of impact on society. I mean, he had an impact on society. He turned a generation or two of minorities into golf fans, maybe who had never watched it before. Hell, I'm not a minority, and I wasn't watching golf very much until Tiger burst on the scene 20 years ago. I started following this young kid and said, what? Oh, my God. And you start to look at some of the things he did early in his career, and he made me a must-see. You know, he became a must-see athlete and event on TV for me. And he did it for a lot of my – that's an impact, too. That's an impact on society. That's an inspiration. I would have felt like he would have been there. They must have just felt as though golf is not a sport, and therefore these are not athletes, golfers that would rank with these great athletes on this list. But I find that very interesting. They do have tennis and so many other things. Jimmy in Toledo. I don't have a ton of time here, Jimmy, but you kind of called in at your benchmark time, so go ahead.
Yeah, listen, I think we're going to need a ruling on Derek Jeter.
Oh, yeah, only, you know, not fully black. He's biracial, yes?
Yeah, I mean, not to make a race thing out of it, but they kind of did that by definition, like making the list itself.
You're right, yeah. Black,
I mean, seriously.
It is kind of weird. Yeah, it is kind of weird. And I don't want to get into that, too, but when you have one white parent and one black parent, why, you know, who gets called black and who gets called non-black? I don't know. Why black? Why does black supersede the white side? I don't really know. I don't really care. But I will say this. If Derek Jeter's name belongs on this list, he probably was ranked a little bit too low because he was a hell of a lot more, successful than some of the other guys.
Well, certainly. And, you know, as far as Tiger Woods, if he didn't make an impact as far as society, then what the hell did they do all that lecturing us about when he first came into golf and the whole Augusta thing and the significance of a young minority going to Augusta?
Absolutely. And he made a lot of minorities who were never golf fans, golf fans. And more importantly, he put a lot of minorities on golf courses, in tee boxes, you know, taking lessons for the very first time because they saw, wow, look at that. And they felt like they could do that. And that's very influential.
How many people know who Lee Elder was because of Tiger Woods? I mean, I didn't know the name. I knew Calvin Pete was. I didn't know. You know, I didn't know who Lee Elder was.
That's a great point. Yeah, Calvin Pete. Very few black golfers, that you can really name prior to Tiger Woods' arrival. And of course, being not just black, as you talked about Jeter, Tiger Woods, of course, is a mixture of a number of things. I think he called
right.
himself
well, that's the thing.
Asian, Caucasian, black, Asian.
Exactly. And Tiger kind of went out of his way to kind of eschew that too. He didn't really embrace that. So maybe they held that against him.
Maybe.
You know,
that's a good point. He did not embrace just the African heritage part of him. He talked about all of it together. He didn't consider himself one race.
I didn't hear the whole list. Was OJ on there?
OJ's not there.
OJ's not there.
OJ's
okay.
not there. There's a lot of running backs there. OJ is not one of them, which is
that's interesting.
Not surprising.
That's
hey, Jimmy, I
got
to run, brother. Normally,
right,
I'll talk
buddy.
Longer to you, but I'm out of time here because I got to get ready for Nick Baumgartner to talk a little college football on the other side of the top of the hour Sports Center right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Got him looking. Swung on and missed. Swung on and missed. He went fishing. 11 strikeouts for Corey Kluber. 30th pitch of the inning for Greg Holland. Fly ball, center field. Blackman chasing. Dives. Can't get it. Geyer scores the tie run. Zimmer will be stopped at third. Austin Jackson delivers down to a his last strike. It's a 1-1 game. Now go swings. High fly ball. Deep center. Back is Blackman. Indians win it. The Indians come back and stun the Rockies with four in the bottom of the ninth.
I knew I got it. I knew it was gonna hit the wall or something. I knew we ended the game right there. It was kind of funny because I'm rounding second and Kipnis is running towards me. I'm like, oh, get out. It's a home run, man. And I was just waiting for umpire or something to say, like, oh, stop at second or something, because he's like high-fiving me at second. I've never done that before.
Boy, you know, when a guy hits a home run to lead off a game, you don't think that that's going to stand up. But the way their guy was pitching, I mean, it about did. But we had some good at-bats in the ninth, though. Austin's at-bat, he had never got to hit off that guy and just kept fighting and probably fouled one by about as little as you can. Just a great at-bat. Well, it feels good when you win. I mean, that's what you're setting out to do. I don't think we get too dramatic in there during a game. We're just trying to win. You feel bad when Brantley gets out. You know, you worry for him, but you still have to win the game.
That's some kind of lineup, too. I mean, there's no let-up in that lineup. You know, first couple hitters of the game, home run, single, and then nothing. It's fun to watch.
All schools aren't created equal. David Shaw once said, we don't recruit certain areas of the country because we know those guys can't qualify to go to Stanford. So there's some truth to that. But listen, you're at UCLA. That's where you chose to go. So you have to adhere to those academic requirements. Don't pick on guys in the SEC. Don't pick on Alabama just because those guys go to a school where the academic requirements aren't as stiff.
When you think about the comment, keep in mind 1% of people actually make it to the NFL.
Yes.
So, yeah, I had high aspirations. I was going to make it to the NFL. I also had tons of buddies that had the same aspirations that didn't make it to the NFL. So I don't like the comment from that standpoint, because you still need to go and get an education.
Yeah.
And there needs to be a backup plan. I'm fine with that being your main plan, but you better say, I'm going to pay attention in school just in case this doesn't work. Now I have a future.
Feel good about the team. Everything that they're doing now, they've already done. They're doing for a second time. And the amount of growth that you can have from doing something for the first time and then doing it the next time can be the biggest leap they had their entire college career. So going from their freshman year to their sophomore year, very excited for that class. Also excited for the junior class. It's hard to believe now that first got hired at Michigan and signed a class a month later that those guys are now juniors. We won 9 straight games, and you know, everybody's high-fiving in the locker room after the game. And they were also there when we lost 3 out of our last 4 games. They know what it feels like. They like the feeling of the high-fiving better than the other. And maybe that's going to motivate them even more.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Good stuff in that montage to start hour number 2 right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo Sports Leader. We'll get back to Josh Rosen's comments a little bit later in this hour as well. If you want to react to that ESPN Top 50 Black Athletes of All Time list that we just ran through, you can do that too when we open up the phone lines at 866-240-1065. Probably not much baseball in this hour. As we get back to college football, because college football is just about to get back to us. Joining us now to talk a little bit about the Michigan Wolverines. On the Wolverines beat for the for MLive.com is Nick Baumgartner. Nick, thanks so much for the time. How are you?
Good, Bob. How are you?
I'm great, man. It's good to have you back. I love this time of the year for the most obvious of reasons, and one of them is having you back on the air to talk about the Wolverines. Expectations have got to be higher and higher going into Jim Harbaugh's third year.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the big question all offseason I keep getting from people is, you know, they lost a lot of starters and they lost a lot of guys to the NFL, and, you know, are expectations still high or should they be tampered down? And my answer, you know, usually is the same in that, you know, you got a $9 million head coach who has to walk the walk, and expectations with Jim Harbaugh are always going to be through the roof. And that's not just coming from us in the media, that's coming from him. You know, I can remember being in Italy with them in the spring and him throwing a coin in a fountain, making a wish, and we asked him what he wished for. He said a championship. I said, what kind? He said a national title. So his expectation is to be the best. And if he's setting that, then everybody else should expect the same. So regardless of what they got coming back, their expectation is to win them all and see what they can do.
You know, in a lot of schools, or for a lot of schools, I would think that the first question, especially if there is an unsettled situation at the quarterback position, would be about the quarterback. And we'll get there, but when you talk Michigan today, it's not about their quarterback or their wide receiver or their latest, greatest dominant player. It is all about Jim Harbaugh. He's the face. He's the and he's the khakis of the program. So let's talk about him. There's another piece on your site right now at MLive.com quoting a CBSSports.com survey about the most overrated coaches in college football. And your buddy Aaron McMahon wrote this one. And Jim Harbaugh's name is there as the most overrated coach, according to the survey of some coaches. What's the story there?
Well, I think that survey was pretty flawed. I think it only polled like 30 coaches or something like that. And I think Nick Saban was actually number two on the list. So, I mean, I guess it says what you will. I mean, I think that it definitely probably lends some credence to the fact that there are a lot of coaches who don't like Jim Harbaugh, frankly, and just to be blunt with it. I mean, there's a lot who don't get him, don't understand him, don't like him, period. And I think that it goes both ways in some of those cases. You know, he said so many times since I've got to know him a little bit that, you know, he doesn't have many friends and and he doesn't really care about it. And that's that. So, but at the same time, you know, he hasn't won a title. He hasn't won a national title. I don't think he won a conference title at Stanford. He got him to the Orange Bowl, obviously, and did great things with that program, and he's helped right the ship here a little bit. But, you know, I mean, results are results. And when you're talking about a guy who a lot of people expect to be in the same, you know, stratosphere as Urban Meyer and Nick Saban, who, for my money, and I think everybody else who's paying attention, those are the two most consistent coaches in the country and maybe the two most of this era. When you're talking about putting another guy in that conversation, then that guy's got to win, and he's got to do more than finish third in his division with 12 NFL players on his team. And I think that some of the criticism that he's gotten in terms of their on-field stuff last year with how they finished the year is completely fair. I think he'd probably even admit that to you. But, you know, bottom line is, you know, he's paid to do a job here. They expect to be as good as good can be, and that's the standard they hold themselves to, and I'm sure that's the standard everybody else holds them to, and until they live up to it, you know, there'll be critics, and they'll be warranted.
Yeah, and you know, what you said about it being a flawed survey, just to throw it out there again from your buddy Aaron McMahon, they only surveyed 26 coaches to start with.
26, yeah. Yeah, 130 teams, right? Yeah.
Right. 48% of those chose not to respond to that particular question about the most overrated.
Right.
That means they're working on the results of 14 head coaches. So the 14 head coaches,
yeah.
Jim Harbaugh is the least popular. He's the most overrated. Nick Saban, as you say, too. Lane Kiffin of FAU is number three, and Lovie Smith at Illinois is number four. Brian Kelly, by the way, who I think is an extraordinarily overrated coach at Notre Dame, got 4%. So it is kind of a strange thing. Guys like Harbaugh, who are extremely successful in a very, very short period of time, they're not liked. Guys like Nick Saban, who are just dominant for a long period of time, they're not liked, and that sort of thing is to be expected. So I'm a Harbaugh fan. I was supportive of them getting him, obviously. I didn't think they would. I just didn't think they had a chance of pulling him away from the NFL. But I'm a big fan, and so I see those stories, and I like to kind of get to the bottom of them. Okay, now let's talk about that quarterback spot. You wrote your piece about Pep Hamilton, who's the passing game coordinator for the Wolverines, talking with reporters about the quarterback job. You know, you would think that a guy like Wilton Spade, who comes back with 2,500 yards and 18 touchdowns and 7 interceptions a year ago, would, you know, pretty much be penciled in as the experienced starter of this team, but not so fast. You've got a redshirt senior, fifth-year senior in John O'Korn, and then you've also got an extraordinarily talented redshirt freshman in Brandon Peters. So is it still those three guys, or has somebody separated from the pack?
Well, I think it's Spade and Peters. You know, nothing against John O'Korn, but, you know, I don't think it's necessarily that he's on the same level as those other two guys. And really, this is a conversation, it's kind of a layered for the reason why it is. I mean, number one, Brandon Peters earned the right to do this, earned the right to compete for this job with the way he performed in spring, the way he trained all offseason, and the way he finished last year in practice squad. He is probably the most talented passer on the team in terms of arm talent and just his physical gifts with the football in his hands. And I'm not sure if anybody would totally disagree with you on that one, even in their locker room in an honest moment. But the thing, he's never played a game. He's a pretty timid guy. He's only a redshirt freshman. And, you know, if you're sitting in a situation where there are no other options, then maybe Brandon Peters would be the guy, and we wouldn't even be talking about this. But, you know, Wilton Spade, obviously, you just read off his numbers. All those were done as a first year starter in his own right last season. And, you know, he did some really good things last year, but at the same time, you know, the reason why this is still a conversation, the reason why he's got to re-earn this job, not just because every player here has to re-earn their job, and not just because Brandon Peters is playing very well enough to where they have to take a good look at him, but, you know, Michigan's offense failed in the three losses last year. They failed to get the job done for long stretches of time for the entire game at Iowa. They couldn't close out against Ohio State, and they struggled for the first three quarters against Florida State. And those were all three narrow losses. I mean, Michigan was, you know, you look back on it now and you say all things whatever they were. You know, Michigan had an argument for being the most talented team in the Big Ten last year, and they didn't get it done. And, you know, you have to take a hard look at what you're doing, especially on offense. And there's more than just Wilson. There's the offensive line had problems and everything else. But sure, you have to take a hard look at what you're doing when you come up short like that. And there was no reason for it. I mean, I've said it 100 times. I've probably said it to you, Bob. I mean, that there was no excuse whatsoever for that team with all that talent to finish a year with no championships, no Big Ten, no college football playoff, didn't even win a bowl. There was zero excuse for any of that to happen. That was a failure and a disappointment. And I think that they've done what they can to look inward and look at everything and see, you know, if maybe a tweak here, a tweak there, maybe a change it. But at the same time, Wilton does have all that experience. And I would assume if all things are equal, then experience would earn him the right to start right away. I don't know if it'd keep him the job, but it would earn him the job if all things are equal, in fact.
At the very beginning. We're talking to Nick Baumgartner, who covers the Wolverines for MLive.com. Let's talk about some of the other positions, position battles. What can you tell us about the way things are going at camp? Are there skill position battles that we need to know of? What names are on the come? What names are returning that are going to be big-time performers for Jim Harbaugh this year?
Yeah, I mean, they're really everywhere. Michigan returned one starter on defense and four on offense, and that's the easy way to boil it down. At the same time, though, they do bring back a lot of guys who played a lot of football last year, not in starting roles, but, you know, their front seven defensively, especially almost all the guys that are going to start there all played serious snap counts last year. And usually they played behind an all Big Ten player because that defense was terrific, of course. The biggest battles right now are still probably corner in defensive backfield. I mean, that seems to be completely open still, both spots, and it may well be something where three or four guys get a crack at it against Florida and they see what happens from there. I think that Michigan has liked the idea of having three really competent corners who kind of carry themselves like starters mm-hmm. in the past. I think they'll probably try to get to that same level right now, but it'll also give other guys a chance to show what they can do. And then, you know, wide receiver, you know, you've got a lot of guys who are just getting here as freshmen. A handful of freshmen, probably one or two at least, are going to play. Some sophomores that played a little bit last year are going to get in there and have a chance to play. So it's going to be young all across the board. Offensive line, same thing. You know, you're replacing three guys there, but you're also excited maybe about some improved athleticism from some higher-level recruits that you brought in. So just a lot of new faces who are going to need some seasoning. And the mantra that they've been spitting out is, you know, you'd rather be young and talented than the opposite. And that does make a lot of sense, but at the same time, you know, you're going to go through growing pains. I mean, they do have a really talented football team, just on basic principle fact, whatever. I mean, they are faster, they are more athletic, but at the same time, you know, they don't have that seasoning. So I think it's going to be, you're going to see growing pains, you're going to see work in progress stuff probably all over the place. And, you know, especially, and that's why I think that starting out against Florida is a great thing for them, to kind of test your mettle against a team that's probably going through a similar situation with replacing guys and having talent all over the place, too. So you ride through what you can get. You test yourself early, and you become a better football team as you go. And I think that's a good situation to be in, and that's exactly what will happen.
We're talking to Nick Baumgartner of MLive.com. A little Wolverines camp report as we get closer and closer to the start of college football season. Jim Cushlin is with us, as always. And Jim's got a question for you. Go ahead.
You know, and you mentioned some of the guys who had left and some of the returning guys a moment ago. And you're also saying you want it to be younger, and I kind of agree with that, except for one area, my offensive line. If I'm a college team, the more experience I have on my offensive line, the better I feel. To that end, Michigan, you know, graduation and all the other stuff, lost both tackles and one of the interior guards, so there's three open spots in the line. What can you tell us about who might have the inside track at those positions?
Yeah, I mean, it's still kind of a rotation. I think they're looking at a couple guys at right tackle, couple guys at right guard. And then center is probably a little more solidified. You know, Patrick Kugler is a fifth-year senior who's been a veteran backup for them for a few years now, and he's had the inside track there at center, though they really, really like true freshman Cesar Ruiz, came from IMG, enrolled early, who is a really, really good prospect and will probably be their center of the future for sure. Mason Cole is going to play left tackle unless something crazy changes. At least he's been repping there for the most part in spring, and I guess we'll see what they do. He could also play center or guard if they need to. So they can shuffle guys around, you know, maybe a Juwan Bushel-Beatty at right tackle, John Runyon, Jr., son of, you know, the NFL and former Michigan great John Runyon. He's a guard tackle combo guy who they really like. Michael Nwenu's big kid from Cass Tech, who was a top 50 recruit a couple of years ago, who they really like. So a lot of guys that are kind of working in there. And I agree with you, Jim. I mean, the point of it is that you want to defer to experience and you feel better about yourself when you have that experience. But Michigan sort of ran into a problem where experience was all they had and there just wasn't anything else. I mean, you mentioned they lost 3 fifth-year seniors to graduation. None of those guys got drafted. You know, none of those guys are NFL draft picks or NFL starting level talent. And I think that there was something to be said about that they kind of topped out, and it was just, you know, you topped out with what you had. They did all they could, and they just weren't good enough. And I think Michigan's hope is that the guys they're bringing in now, even though they're less experienced, have higher ceilings, and maybe if you can coach them up faster, they can get there at some point this year, and then for the future, you have it locked and loaded and ready to go. So there is optimism there, and there's a chance for them to build some depth. Same time, three new guys, three new faces, going against a defense in Florida that always has athletes and talent. You're going to have problems, and you're going to have missteps and hiccups and everything else that young guys always have up front. So you're just going to have to deal with it, ride through it, and see what you can do.
There's a piece on the website today also that you put together on Rashawn Gary. Let's talk about him. Your headline is Rashawn Gary knows it's time for him to be great, whether he's ready or not. How important is he, and what is your prognostication for him?
Well, it's a huge year for him. I mean, he's important for so many reasons in that they think he's their best, most talented, physically gifted football player. And, you know, they expect him to perform like that. And I think that, you know, a guy who can be an anchor as a strong tight end, who can kind of anchor your defensive line and change the way things are done. I know you guys are in Ohio, and not to compare Rashawn Gary to this, but, you know, when Joey Bosa was rocking and rolling at Ohio State, it changed everything. I mean, the guy could get doubled and tripled and everything else, and it frees up everyone else to do all kinds of things. And it just helps and changes your entire defense. And that's their expectation, for Rashawn Gary. Now he's got to go do it. And that's the big thing. And, you know, I can remember back 2 years ago when, Jabril Peppers was going into his second year and he barely played as a freshman. And all year long, they basically said, you know, he's the most talented player we have on this team. And it was just going to be a matter of he's got to go do it. And, you know, Peppers wasn't perfect over 2 years, but I think it's safe to say he lived up to his billing as the most talented player on that team. He changed their team. And everything he did. I mean, he played so many different positions. He was a return threat. All these little things that he did changed the way they played football and gave them maybe more swagger, maybe more athleticism in some areas and some more impact. So I think that if you're Rashawn Gary with the physical talent he has, I mean, it's off the charts. And that's what they expect him to do, is go play like the guy who everybody wanted 2 years ago in recruiting, who was the number one player in the country, consensus by far, who had an offer to play anywhere he wanted. And, you know, you've had guys come through here, NFL scouts and everything else, and look at him and say, this guy should be a no doubt, you know, NFL starter in a handful of years. And now it's all that hype. And now it's time to go see if he can do it. And that's why it's getting down to that time for him. I mean, you know, ready or not, whatever. I mean, sophomore, maybe this comes a little earlier than expected, but same time, when you're a top flight guy like that and you're supposed to be great and everybody says it and everybody sees it, you got to go prove it. And sometimes that pressure can be a lot to deal with, but we'll see if he can handle it.
Nick Baumgartner joining us with a little preview of Michigan football in 2017. Training camp, of course, underway. A lot of good work being done and a lot of the questions about the quarterback position and whether or not Wilton Spate is going to keep that job or a younger star like, for crying out loud, Brandon Peters. Is going to be the guy. Let me ask you, USA Today says 10-2. Just to kind of throw a couple of national predictions out there, USA Today says 10-2 for the Wolverines. I'll tell you what, I'm looking at the schedule. That is an ambitious record to predict because it is not an easy schedule. The three, even, you know, the three non-conferences to start the year are challenges with Florida and Cincinnati and Air Force, which is no pushover at all. And obviously, you know, the regular Big Ten grind. That's a pretty ambitious schedule or a prediction, I should say. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, especially when you look at it like this. You know, I can see them getting through Florida, and I don't really have much hesitation if. And arguing with somebody who says they think Michigan will beat Florida. I got no problem with that. You know, they're both, I think that's going to be a clunker. I think they're both two teams that are kind of searching for what they've got. And, you know, at that point, I think I probably default with the better coach. And I think that's Jim Harbaugh. So I would have no problem there. But the thing where I get into this, or where I hear some of these people say maybe 10 or 11, you know, Michigan hasn't beaten anybody on the road of substance in like a decade. I mean, you got to go to Penn State. You got to go to Wisconsin. And then you got to play Ohio State, who you haven't beaten barely at all for this century, you got them here, regardless of where you got them, you got them again. So you look at those three games, and at some point, it's hard to say they're going to win those games when they haven't done any of those things in recent history. I know it's only year three for Harbaugh, but, you know, Jim Harbaugh's teams haven't beaten anybody of substance on the road.
Right.
You know, last year they beat Rutgers and Michigan State. Rutgers was terrible, and Michigan State was only slightly better than Rutgers. So those weren't anything that I would write home about. Same thing in year one. I mean, I think they beat a slumping Penn State team at the end of the year on the road, but that wasn't at night, and that wasn't, you know, one of these things where Penn State fans were the way they were last year. So, you know, to pencil in them beating a Wisconsin or a Penn State on the road without having seen it this early, I have a hard time with that. And then again, until they beat Ohio State, I have a hard time thinking them beating them either, because it's just one of those things where you got to show it. I got to see it before I'm going to sit here in August and say, I think you can do that. So, or I think you will do that, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
But, yeah, 10 or 11 seems ambitious to me. I would fall on 9 or 8. Swing in there. I guess the Florida game maybe would have a lot to do with that, but I don't think this team should be any worse than 8-4. And I think 9-3 would probably be an area where I'd say, okay, you know, as long as you're competitive in all those games, 9-3 is probably not a terrible year for you, but, you know, this is also Michigan and you're looking for titles. So
that's what I was going to say. Is 9-3 going to be acceptable at this stage of the build? And I call it a build rather than a rebuild, but I guess you could say rebuild. You know, under Jim Harbaugh, is that an acceptable, you know, level step where they are?
If you're 9-3 and you check off one of the boxes I just said, where you beat one of those teams that are good on the road in a hostile environment and show you can do that, or you beat Ohio State, and if you finish 9-3, I think you'd be fine. Because that way you've made some progress in the areas where you're really lacking, and that's competing on the road in high-level environments against a high-level football team. And more importantly, I mean, for me, the whole thing is still Ohio State. It just comes down to that. If you beat them and you're 9-3, then it's fine. I think it's, and you go to the Citrus Bowl and you play whoever and you're feeling good about yourself and you move on and you have all these guys coming back. But you have got to beat, you can't go 0-3 if you're Harbaugh against Urban Meyer. The more you lose to them, the harder it is for you to recruit. They recruit against Ohio State every day, all year long. And right now, they don't have any ammo that's real, to go against Ohio State. But what do you say? What do you tell a kid it's you or Ohio State? What do you tell him? I don't know. Because Ohio State's argument is we beat them every single year, and it's not even, you know, it was close last year, whatever. We still beat them every single year, and
right.
Michigan has no defense for that. So you have to go beat them. So one of these teams has to just dig down deep and go do it. And it's one of those things, I compared it to kicking a wall down, but that wall is, you know, guarded with kind of bulletproof glass and Kevlar and everything else. It's not going to be easy, and no one's going to just bend over and let you do it and just give it to you. But somebody at some point here, one of these teams is going to have to go beat them, and they're going to have to beat them at their best because Urban Meyer's not slowing down, and it's not going to be one of these things, I don't think, where they just slump around and just let you just sneak in the back door. I think it's just going to have to be done, and that, for me, that at this point becomes kind of a definition thing. If you can't beat them still, I don't know. I mean, last year was one of those two. You know, you had better talent, you had more experience, and I think for most of that game you saw they were more talented, couldn't get it done. So, I mean, at some point you got to do it. Otherwise, you're just talking.
I think that's fair to say, too. Really, really great analysis, Nick. That's why we like to invite you on. Thanks for entertaining us and enlightening us on the status of the Wolverines right now. It'll be interesting to see if Spate keeps that quarterback job or not. I am, by the way, not trying to hate on the kid. If experience is right, and as you said, all things are equal. If all things are equal, the experienced guy will get that job. But I want to look for an upgrade there if I'm a Michigan fan, and I want to see what the young golden arm of Brandon Peters can do. But that's just a personal opinion, and we'll see where it goes from there. Keep up the great work, Nick Baumgartner at MLive.com. Thank you, Nick.
All right, guys. Take care.
You got it. Have a good one. All right, there you go. So that's Nick Baumgartner. Got to get a bottom-of-the-hour timeout, but not before I remind you. You have got to check out. If you want to get your Mexican food on, my goodness gracious, you got to check out Don Juan Mexican Bar and Grill. The brand-new location is at the Franklin Park Mall. It's absolutely all brand new inside the bar, the booths, the tables, the chairs, everything. It's a great atmosphere. It's an authentic Mexican feel. Plus, there's a great comfy lounge to kick back with a few drinks maybe if you want before sitting down for dinner. Now, here's the best part. They have happy hour every single day from 3 to 6 p.m., not just on a Wednesday afternoon, not just a Tuesday night, 7 days a week from 3 to 6 p.m. with insane drink specials. Now, if you're trying to watch your weight, too, you want to try their signature margarita. It's their version of the skinny margarita, healthier way to have your margie. Plus, you've got, or Margie, if you prefer. Plus, they've got Taco Tuesdays every week. That's tacos for just a buck. Do not forget their original location in Maumee on Dussel Drive, but the new location is at Franklin Park. It's on the Monroe Street side between JCPenney and Dillard's, directly across from Nick and Jimmy's, not the food court. Don't find it in the food court. You won't find it there. You enter from the outside directly from the brand new paved parking lot. That's Don Juan Mexican Bar and Grill now at the Franklin Park Mall.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, rolling right along we are. 4:41, that means 19 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you right here on the Extravaganza. Really good conversation with Nick Baumgartner. Cush, who's going to win that job either?
Right now I'm leaning Spate, but I don't know. At the end of the day, that's where I would have to lean, but
who
it's still...
Who do you want to win that job if you're a Michigan fan?
Oh.
Not that you are, but...
Oh, tough call.
Yeah. I want to see the youngsters.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but you know
if you're
what
not
is?
Sold on Wilton Spate, I guess then I would go that route.
Yeah, that's the reason why. And Brandon Peters is certainly supposed to be the guy, supposed to have the best arm of anybody at the entire camp, anybody in the roster. He's been pulling, talking about Harbaugh, he has been pulling some of the top quarterback prospects in the country the last 3 years. You know, his first year started recruiting very late, obviously.
Right.
But the McCaffrey kid, too, right? He's supposed to be the real deal. The brother of Christian McCaffrey, who is the son. They are both the sons of longtime NFL receiver Ed McCaffrey. But Dylan McCaffrey is the real deal. He's he was like a five-star recruit, blue chip, whatever you want to call him, for the Wolverines this past season. So he'll be a true freshman. He'll, of course, get redshirted. But I want to see him soon. And I can't because I'm going to have to see Brandon Peters for that. And I'm going to have to see, who knows who's going to be next in line, obviously. But that's what I'm talking about. You're talking about seriously big-time arms. You know, Dylan McCaffrey is a 6'5", prototypical drop-back type of quarterback. As I mentioned, the bloodlines run very deep. Pro players for a father and for a brother now is probably going to be the rookie of the year. That's my pick as a running back for the Carolina Panthers. So. I'm very excited about watching guys like Peters and McCaffrey play. And in a strange way, Jim, going to Ohio State now, and we're going to talk tomorrow, right? We're going to talk with Landis tomorrow?
Indeed. Bill Landis right now, he's slated for the first hour tomorrow on the Buckeyes. Couldn't do it today, otherwise I would have put them both today.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to talking to him because it's a very similar situation there, and that's going to sound really, really stupid when I say this because of the tremendous career that JT Barrett has already had at Ohio State, but I'm looking for new blood there. You know, it's weird. He's back basically as a fifth-year senior. He's a guy who would have been a Heisman Trophy candidate had he not gotten hurt 2 years ago when he did get hurt and allowed Cardale Jones to lead the Buckeyes to the national championship.
Right, yeah.
And then last year he kind of had a strange season because Jones, not last year, it was 3 years ago to 2 years ago, Jones got the start over him because of that, and then he had kind of an inconsistent thing going on, and now he's back for a final run because he probably could have in the right circumstances should have gone to the NFL given how much time he's already put in at the college level, but his prospects weren't good.
Yeah,
and this might be it for him. This might be where his football career ends, is on the field with Ohio State, and the good news for them and for him is they may be good enough to win a championship again. They're going to start out, according to a lot of the polls, at number 2 behind Alabama. They still have a ton of talent, and he is going to be at the center of that. But the strange, weird part about that, which is how I got onto this, for me is I'm looking to see some of the young prototype quarterbacks rather than the runner slash passer that he is, et cetera, et cetera. I want to see a guy like Joe Burrow.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want to see a guy like that come in and see what kind of production he can bring, because he set all kinds of records at the college level or at the high school level in Ohio, and there's a ton of these guys that I'm just anxious to see come up and get in. That's why I really think that John O'Korn has no chance at this in Michigan now, going back, because I go back and forth between Columbus and Ann Arbor. But I really don't think John O'Korn, he's a fifth-year senior, he doesn't have a chance at this. I think Jim Harbaugh is not interested in a one-year guy. He's interested in who's going to be my guy for the next 2 or 3 seasons. Is it going to be Wilton Spate getting that job again, or is it going to be a guy like Brandon Peters, which then makes the job of a Christian McCaffrey next season that much harder to unseat the new young, who would be a redshirt sophomore next year starter for Jim Harbaugh. Competition is great. That's the thing. Competition is great. You want to stock your program with as many stud QBs as you possibly can and let the competition sort itself out. And that's what Jim Harbaugh has done, bringing blue-chip quarterback after blue-chip quarterback on board. It's up to him and Pep Hamilton to figure out which one of them plays, you know, which one of them plays first and which one of those plays longest.
Yeah, no doubt about it there. And it also points out that one of those stark differences that you may not think of, but is so obvious when you do think about it for a second. You know, competition at quarterback. If we're talking college football, like in this conversation with Michigan, that's actually a good thing. If you're talking a quarterback competition for your NFL team, that's probably a bad thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good point. Well, that's for the obvious reasons, because you have turnover in college. You know, you can only play 4 years before you got to leave, or you might leave even before that.
Right.
But that's a very, very good point. If you've got quarterback uncertainty at the NFL level, you're in trouble. If you've got quarterback uncertainty at the college level, it's part of the game. You know, you guys graduate, and then new guys come in and try to take their jobs.
Or if you're a big-time stud with draft prospects, you might only be there for two seasons.
Right, that's exactly right. That's entirely possible as well. So, speaking of quarterbacks and college football, I want to go back to what we talked about yesterday toward the end of the show. And, Jim,
yes.
I kind of threw something out about an idea about ways to kind of solve the Josh Rosen problem.
Right, right.
I still don't know that I necessarily have the answer, but I want to talk about Rosen again just to kind of, I don't know, stand up to that young kid. I gave him a lot of credit yesterday. Josh Rosen, the quarterback at UCLA, All-American candidate, going to be one of the top 10 players picked probably in the draft next spring. I gave him a lot of room yesterday because I understood his point. I know how hard it is to be a college student. I know how hard the hours are. If you carry a full course load of 15 hours, and some carry more, some will only carry 12, but if you carry the standard 15-hour course load in a semester-based type situation, you have obviously all of those classes per week, and then you have probably labs if any of them are science. Then you have papers to write, you have homework to do, you have group projects to work on. All these kinds of things come into play, and it's almost a full-time job being a student. If you are a college football player, you have practices, you have meetings, you have weight room sessions, you have film sessions. You have individual drills. You have time that you're supposed to spend studying your playbook on your own, all of which is almost like a full-time job, too. So when Josh Rosen said yesterday, or actually he said over the weekend, and we talked about it yesterday, that football and school don't go together, I kind of understood where he was coming from. Boy, that is a very tough thing to do. But I was listening to First Take today, and I want to give some props and some credit here to Will Cain, who was on the air with the guys doing First Take on TV. And he made one of the most obvious points that I'm really mad at myself for not making myself, because I've talked about this. I played college football at the Division III level. Our schedules were crazy. I can't imagine it's too terribly much different at the Division I level. All those things that I told you about you have to do, I had to do. So I know it. I know it's true. What I didn't think of is the other obvious part of this. Do you know how hard it is to go to school while paying for it by working a near full-time job at the same time? Because some 70%, and I don't know what study Will had to source that, but he said that some 70% of college students are working in the neighborhood of 30 hours a week in addition to doing their school, their school responsibilities. And, God forbid, if you want to be in a club, you want to do anything socially, et cetera, right? He said that some 70% are working 30 hours a week to pay for their school. And while, you know, your job as a waiter while at college might not be the same thing as lifting weights, your job working at the movie theater, guilty, hand in the air, I did that. I was a projectionist. That's why I know every word of The Abyss, because I started that reel probably 700 times back in 1989. or whatever your job is, it might not be being at a film session like a football, but you still are required to be there for X number of hours for a very small paycheck just to help you get through school, right? Just to help you get through financially. Your job is no less difficult than the job of a Josh Rosen, and you do it without the promise, potentially, of multi-millions of dollars for your efforts at the next level. When you graduate as a regular student, you had to do all that work, then you're going to go take a job. If it's in your field of study, God bless you and good on you, because that's not a guarantee by any stretch of the imagination. So many people are finding out that the college loans that they have to take out and all of the money that they pay, simply not worth the return, because they're just not getting jobs in their field that pay off those college debts and pay them and pay their house payments and so on and so forth and allow them to start families, etc. So I felt, when I listened to Will today make that very basic, simple statement, I felt a little embarrassed that I hadn't really considered all of this myself. But you know what, Josh Rosen? I'm at the point here where I'm about to say you're not wrong about the challenge of being a college football player and a college student at the same time, but shut up, because you're not alone. It is just as difficult being a working college student going to school as it is a football playing college student, because you both have full-time jobs outside of the actual classroom setting. And I think he really comes off as being a little bit petty, a little bit selfish, a little bit, I don't know, maybe a little bit too full of himself. And the other part of that, by the way, is after your 4 years on campus, if you're Josh Rosen, or 3 years if you're going to the NFL, which he probably is after this season, after your time on campus, you do, whether you make it to the NFL or not, that's the key here. And we all know that a teeny tiny percentage of college players make it to the NFL. What's the draft every year? 12, we talk about this, and I always forget the number, but 7 rounds times 32 picks is how many?
It's like 255-ish is usually Mr. Times, Irrelevant.
I'm sorry, say again?
Something like 255-ish is usually right around where Mr. Irrelevant gets picked.
7 times 32 is 224.
Okay, well,
so
don't
forget. 224 guys get drafted, then you get a bunch of guys signed as undrafted free agents, and they get an opportunity. So you're talking about maybe 300 so guys go to the NFL each year, each spring. And you're talking about 85 players times roughly 130 or so Division I FCS schools, right? That's 11,050 guys fighting for roughly 300 jobs. Chances are you're not going. So whether you go to the NFL or not, what you aren't going to do is go to the mailbox every day and see a bill to pay back the student loan that you also paid the tuition and room and board and books and everything else on while you were there. So I have a little bit less sympathy for Josh Rosen's complaint about, you know, players and sports and football and school not going together than I did yesterday. I'm a little bit more on the side of, you know what, you are being given a golden opportunity that nobody else will ever get. Do you have to work to play football? Yes. That job requires a lot of hours. But if you're not playing football, you're probably still working. And those jobs are requiring a lot of hours in order for people just to make the payments for their tuition, for their room, for their board, for that meal plan, for their books, whatever it is the case might be. So I wanted to throw that in there and give attribution to Will Cain for opening my eyes to the most obvious of responses to this thing. And it is obvious. Now, to the point, what can be done to lighten the load a little bit, if anything at all? What can be done to take a football player like a Josh Rosen or guys who are maybe less than Josh Rosen, maybe it's the third string left tackle who's also struggling to keep his grade point average above 2.5, et cetera. How can this person get the extra time he needs? How can this person, these athletes get the extra tutoring they need or whatever the case might be when they've got so much time to put into football? And how are you supposed to, you know, how are you supposed to balance that scale? Well, my answer to that question is, utilize the summers. Utilize the downtime for the rest of the student population. And I already hear the complaints. I can already tell what people are going to say. They're going to say, wait. You want these guys to not have any time off during the year? You want these guys to play football in the spring, because you know there's spring football in practice, right? You want them to lift in the wintertime. You want them to practice and get in shape for camp in the summer, then they report in the summer, and then they play the season in the fall. And you want them to do what? Take classes in the summer? How is that fair? How is that just? And my answer is, there's nothing fair, to be quite honest with you. There really isn't. There's nothing fair about the system. The universities are going to get rich. They're going to continue to make millions and millions of dollars off the labor of these players. But these players are going to continue to get educations that should be invaluable to them if they use them properly. And the bottom line is, if you want both, because you're probably not going to make it to the NFL based on the numbers that I just gave you, you're probably not going to make it, then you just achieve the degree that you're looking for, the diploma. You achieve that in whatever way it is most convenient for you. And guess what? It might be more convenient to wake up casually and go to some classes in the summertime than it is to cram them all into the fall semester and even the spring semester when you consider all of the other responsibilities that you have. Why not allow the most of these guys to attend classes in the summer? And secondly, Jim Cushlin, in order to alleviate some of their missing classes when they're on road trips and these sorts of things, why not allow them essentially to attend class online? Why not? The University
that is becoming
of Phoenix,
a bigger thing as we keep going forward.
The University of Phoenix, and how many times you hear those commercials on the radio?
Too many.
University of Phoenix is, you know, has a couple hundred thousand students getting their degrees, and these degrees don't say online degree. Wink, wink. It's nothing, you know, not real. It's a real legitimate degree, is just as much as if you had sat in classrooms in person and walked down the aisle and got your diploma, et cetera, et cetera. So why not allow these guys to have a little bit of a different type of college experience if it is deemed that they need anything extra over the regular working student? As I described, I don't necessarily think they do. But if there is something, why not just make it a little easier so they don't have to go to 15 hours in classrooms every fall semester while also trying to meet that incredibly rigorous college football demand? There are answers here, is my point. There are answers here, and I think people just need to look a little bit harder for them. Okay, I hear the music, and I also see the clock, before the latter. We're out of time, is what we're trying to say here. And that's okay, because drive time is coming up next. So stay where you are with Mr. Mike Miller. And then tomorrow, we're back again for the next extravaganza, Thursday afternoon edition, starting at 3 o'clock. And we'll talk a little bit of Ohio State football with Bill Landis tomorrow as well. So until then, have yourself a great afternoon. Be well, be safe. We're out. Bye-bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.